Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
We're going to have a great conversation today. So glad to have you tuned in. I'm Neil Stavem. This is Connecting Faith. Ted Ross at the controls. Carissa's at the phones. And Ted, we know the words that Jesus said, unless you become like a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. Mm-hmm. And, you know, think about what is it about childlikeness that opens our eyes to see God? Well, maybe one aspect might be the simple ability to see things as they really are without the need for a theological explanation.
Right, you know? Keep it simple.
That's right. Well, our guest today maybe could adapt that statement to suggest the requirement for good science is to become childlike again and to be willing to say the emperor has no clothes when the evidence clearly shows it. So, and this is a conversation I'm looking forward to for a long time. When I first saw the book cover, that was enough to kind of attract me, and the book is every bit as intriguing as the cover. And today we're going to see the majesty in the micro, the complexity in the cell, and the purpose and the amazing design that surrounds us at every moment. And in the process, hopefully we'll learn how, without advanced degrees in scientific fields, that we can affirm that this world began and operates by design. Mm-hmm. Thinking about that verse, Psalm 139, truly we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And we're going to emphasize the word made today.
I love conversations like this. It causes us to stop and consider God's handiwork and its design. It's by design.
Well, we are going to have to put our thinking caps on today.
Okay.
Summer school's in session.
All right.
And we're ready to learn and grow in our faith. I remember early on in my college years reading Francis Schaeffer, and one of the lines that he kept coming back to was he talked about materialism, material energy shaped by chance. So, and our guest today has run up against that in his research. And we're going to jump in and have a great conversation with Douglas Axe. Dr. Axe is a molecular biologist and director of Biologic Institute. It's a nonprofit research organization launched by the Discovery Institute in Seattle. And he has, after his undergraduate studies at the University of Berkeley, and doctoral work at Caltech. He held postdoctoral and research scientific positions at the University of Cambridge, the Cambridge Medical Research Council Center, and the Babrin Institute in Cambridge. He worked as a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Protein Engineering under the supervision of Nobel winner, I think, Alan Fairst, I think it is, and the University of Cambridge. And his list of credentials would take a little more time than what we have allotted for the show.
Right.
Anyway, we're just honored to have Doug with us today. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey, it's great to be here.
This new book that we're going to talk about is fascinating reading, and I would just encourage listeners. We do have some copies that we're going to give away. If you have interest at all in biology, science, intelligent design, that this will be a very fascinating read. The book is called Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. Dr. Axe, just to find out a little background, is this something that was ID, something that you had been interested in early on and wanted to pursue in science just to see where it led?
It is. In fact, before I knew the term ID, intelligent design, I felt led to go into this. It goes all the way back to my undergraduate days where I was a new Christian, relatively new Christian, 4 years in the Lord, when I started at UC Berkeley studying chemical engineering and in the physical sciences was getting the distinct impression that the professors up front were preaching something called materialism, which is the idea that there is nothing but matter and energy, atoms and molecules. And one lecture in particular, a chemistry professor was using that platform to speak against arguments for the existence of God based on the second law of thermodynamics. I won't go into the argument, but at that point as a 4-year-old in the Lord, 18-year-old, I was thinking, you know, this person is abusing authority by using the platform in that way to preach. And at some point, I want to come back and address these things. So that got me off on a trajectory where I really started seeking direction as to whether I might use science to demonstrate the truth. And that's what I've had the honor to be able to do for about 25 years now.
Well, the subtitle of the book, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed, the book, captivating reading called Undeniable. Talk about the difference between science and scientism. You addressed that early on.
Yeah, scientism is maybe a term that most people haven't heard of. Science is just the study of the natural world. So it's taking observation and reasoning, putting them together and trying to figure out how things work out there. And that's a wonderful pursuit. I'm a scientist and I love science. Scientism is something different. It's more a philosophy or a worldview. It's the idea that there is no path to the truth other than doing science. So once you enter into scientism, you are saying there is nothing other than matter and energy, atoms and molecules. The entire sum of existence is the physical world that the physicists and the chemists explore. And because there is nothing else, the only path to the truth is by doing science. And that is a false philosophy. In fact, it's not a healthy philosophy even for doing science, because to do science properly, you have to believe in things that aren't atoms and molecules, matter and energy, truth foremost among them. You have to believe that there is truth out there to be discovered, and truth is not on the periodic table. So you have to accept things that are not part of the material realm in order to do science.
And especially when it gets into origins, right, development, I mean that if all we have is materialism, I guess that's why we are down the road we're at today, aren't we?
Yes. Once you put on the hat of scientism, which you don't need to and you shouldn't put on to be a scientist, you're declaring that all answers to all questions will be found in the material realm. So if someone wants to propose that, hey, maybe God did this or maybe God started the universe, that's not allowed. You have to come up with a material answer to all questions.
Well, in some people will argue, and I know you address it too, that, well, ID, intelligent design, that's just a backdoor way to get God into the classroom or the research library. I mean, you've dealt with that along your research journey. Just say a bit more about how people respond to ID.
Well, that particular, I started off doing this work in the UK, where it's a slightly different political environment there. There is no separation of church and state, as you may know, in England. And it's the British context that gave rise to our context in the United States. Here, people are very nervous, as you know, in the public school system about anyone saying anything that might hint at biblical faith. And the moment anyone challenges something that's really coming from another faith position, like Darwinism or evolutionism or scientism, everyone gets all upset and thinks that you're trying to bring religion into the classroom, not realizing that the ideas that are being taught in the classroom today, as though they are standard science, really are, some of them really are tainted with materialist philosophy, and therefore they're religious in nature in themselves.
Well, and even as you suggest that, you know, because all of us have biases, we probably can't, you know, guard against it completely. But is it possible to truly question everything? And is that shouldn't that be kind of a foundation in the scientific community?
You sometimes hear it said, I think the Neil deGrasse Tyson at the beginning of the Cosmos, the newer Cosmos series, says that's what scientists do. They question absolutely everything. Well, he doesn't question everything. Nobody questions everything. Everyone starts with a worldview, a way of understanding reality, and they use that worldview in order to go and study reality. And more often than not, we're trying to actually, as humans, being human, we're trying to sort of reinforce what we already believe. And scientists do this all the time. They'll have an idea, a hunch about how things work. They're not actually going out to prove that their hunch is wrong. They're going out to prove that their hunch is right. And that actually works. Okay, it works quite well in science as long as they're willing to accept it when it turns out that they're wrong, as long as they're willing to have peers who disagree with them and submit their evidence to peer review, and the peers are willing to say whether this study is right or wrong. So diversity of opinion, diversity of worldview is actually a healthy thing for science. And regrettably, that's something that's disappearing these days.
And in fact, as you address that, it's if we don't get the results we want, we actually suppress the results that go against our hopes.
That's a danger, but it's only a danger for me. I believe that life is designed, and I argue in the book why I think everyone should believe that. Now, I can go into a lab and do experiments, and I have, that are arguing that evolution doesn't work. And someone might say, well, your bias, Doug, is affecting your science. And that's a possibility, I have to admit, because everyone has these biases. But it's not going to be possible for me to suppress the Darwinian worldview, is it? Because I just don't have the authorities to do that. All the universities are teaching Darwinism. All of them are subscribing to this materialistic, scientistic philosophy. I, little old me, I can't do anything to stop that. Whereas if you flip it around and say, can the establishment stop people like me from challenging evolutionism and scientism and Darwinism? The answer is yes, because they hold all the power. All the positions of authority are held by people who subscribe to this worldview, and they can suppress ideas that go against that worldview. And that is actually happening. And I tell my personal story as just one example of how things unfold when a position of power, when scientific authority is used to reinforce and to protect an orthodox position.
We generally like the term whistleblowing, think it's a good idea, but in Dr. Douglas Ask's case, it wasn't so good. But we're going to go on after just a short break to talk a little bit about the universal design intuition and some of the findings from Dr. Douglas Ask, who's a molecular biologist, director of the Biologic Institute, and he's written an amazing new book called Undeniable. The subtitle is How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. We do have some copies of this fascinating book to give away, and we'll do a drawing here at the end of the hour. Whenever we have resources like that, we do a drawing, and you can sign up for a copy and put your name in the hat for that at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. Or if it's more convenient, you want to just submit your application, I guess, if you will, online. You can go to myfaithradio.com, click on the Connecting Faith show page, use the email link there to send us your contact information. We'll put you in for the drawing for Undeniable. And more with Douglas Axe in a moment. We see evidence of design all around us, and in fact, it is undeniable. And there's a new book out that addresses how biology confirms our intuition that life is designed, in spite of what we continually hear and what gets promoted day in and day out. And it's important because we all need to ask that question: to what or to whom do we owe our existence? And that was the starting point for Professor Douglas Axe's book called Undeniable. Doug is a director of the Biologic Institute, a nonprofit research organization launched by Discovery Institute in Seattle. And you can find out more about his writings and work on the website undeniabledesign.com, undeniabledesign.com. Doug, you mentioned something, and we want to jump into it, the universal design intuition. Explain what that is.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. This has been widely acknowledged by people who are not people of faith. I quote in the book a woman named Alison Gopnik, who's a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, who wrote in the Wall Street Journal that by elementary school age, children start to invoke an ultimate godlike designer to explain the complexity of the world around them, even children brought up as atheists. And when I read that, I thought, that is interesting and telling, because it means there's something instinctive in us, something innate in us, something intuitive that by a very early age tells us when we look at living things, you look at a butterfly, you look at a cat or a dog, you know that these things were made, that they didn't just happen. And of course, when many of these kids grow up into their preteen and teen years, they start to be educated. And the message of education is frequently that that intuition is false, that not all intuitions are true. This one happens to be false. And the correct understanding of life and its origin is the Darwinian understanding. But it's interesting that even though that new message starts to be instilled in us from our through our education in our teen years and on up, no one ever actually fully believes it. Francis Crick once famously said that biologists must constantly keep in mind that the things they examine were not designed but rather evolved. So this is a top-notch biologist saying that even he has to suppress this intuition. It keeps cropping up. Biologists are constantly talking about life as though it were designed, as though all of its parts had functions, and they have to keep sort of splashing their face with cold water to say, no, that's not what I meant. I didn't mean that they are designed for a purpose. I mean that they look like they have a purpose, but they all evolved without purpose.
It is fascinating that, and, you know, of course, we as a culture today just revere science above all else. In fact, you know, that's one of the questions, is science only for the elite? You use the phrase common science, which sounds a lot like common sense. I'm wondering, are they related? Can they be related?
Yeah, and I coined the term common science to refer to the sort of science that we all do from an early age. So that four-year-old who looks at a butterfly and says to himself or herself, hey, God made that. That's a designed thing. That's actually, that idea didn't come out of thin air. It came out of a recognition that certain things don't just happen. They're only done if someone makes them happen. And if that's true of ordinary things in the home, I use an origami crane as an example. If a four-year-old came across a folded piece of paper that looks like a bird on the table and didn't see mom or dad or a sibling fold it, they would nonetheless know that somebody made this, somebody put some time into this and crafted this, and they would want to know how do you make this sort of thing. It's that same intuition that tells children from an early age that life is designed. Somebody put this thing together. And not all intuitions are true, but it turns out that this one, if you press on it and tease it apart and try to find out what is behind it, it turns out there's good scientific basis for it, and it holds water. This one is true. So I call that science, the simple science of observation, everyday observation, and common sense reasoning. I call that common science. Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, we don't have to be PhDs to be able to understand and operate. But it goes back to what that design, if something has a function, there's a design behind it, right? Is that essentially it?
Yes, and biologists will constantly, they always talk about things having function, because you don't, when you look inside a cell and you see thousands of proteins doing special things that keep the cell alive and the various organs of the body doing their special things to keep the organism alive, of course you talk about function. There's no other way to talk about life. But when people are talking about the origin of these things, then they want to back off and say, well, they have a function in how the thing works, but that doesn't mean that there's a purpose behind them. It turns out to be very awkward to try to have such remarkable functional systems without there having been a purpose for them to function the way they do.
You distinguish between fiddling and invention, or innovation. Say a bit more about that.
Yeah. So just in the common sense, I use human examples. If you have a motor that won't run, sometimes you can put a drop of oil here, or you can, you know, hit it, give it a little shake, and the thing will start to run. You can have pieces of equipment that aren't quite working, but all the parts are there, and they just need a little adjustment, and then they start to work, or they start to work well. That's what I call fiddling. It's just It's doing minor adjustments that allow something that has all its pieces together and is designed to work in order to work well. It turns out that natural selection is pretty good at doing that. It can fiddle with systems, but it can't invent them. So it's entirely different, two entirely different exercises, the fiddling, the putting a drop of oil here or a turn of a wrench there, versus sitting down and engineering something, designing something to work and then putting it together. Those are two entirely different exercises. It turns out that natural selection, although it's been claimed to do the latter, to be an engineer, to be able to invent things, it doesn't do that at all. It does fiddling reasonably well, and I give some examples that we've actually observed in the lab where you can take an enzyme and a protein that does chemistry, and you can beat it up to the point where it's not working well at all by mutating it, and natural selection can repair it and make it work well. But you have an enzyme there, and you have an enzyme that works. It's just not working well. What it can't do is, from scratch, invent a new enzyme, invent a protein that does chemistry. And we've demonstrated that. And we think that's true not just at the level of single molecules, although that's the level where it's easiest to go into the lab and test it. We think that's true all the way up for new forms of life, for organs, for cell types, for new molecules as well.
I think you wrote down the statement, nothing evolves unless it already exists. Maybe just react to that statement a bit more.
I quote, actually, an acquaintance of mine from my Cambridge days. His name is Dan Tofik. He's at the Weizmann Institute in Israel. And he would not agree with me about intelligent design. He's a very sharp guy who works on enzymes, as I do. And he's come to realize that you don't actually get the natural selection won't do anything to refine some function, call it function X, unless the thing already has function X. And this is just the fiddling statement that I just made, that if you have something that performs a function, you can use mutation and natural selection to adjust it so that it performs that function better. But what you can't do is just get the function out of thin air. And that's what Dan was saying in that quote. It has this catch-22. Nothing evolves unless it already exists. And if that's true, then Darwin's theory is not really a theory of origins. It's a theory of adjustment and of population shifts. It's not a theory of origins at all.
We want to find more about origins. That's what we're talking about today in reviewing Doug Ack's new book called Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. You can find out more about it on the website undeniabledesign.com. And we've got some copies of the book to give away. It's fascinating reading. You can sign up for that with a phone call. We'll do a drawing here at the top of the hour. 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. You may have a question as well for Professor Ack. I'd love to have you join the conversation. He's a molecular biologist, director of the Biologic Institute in Seattle. We're going to talk about the wobbly dominoes of accident, coincidence, and repetition coming up in a moment. Stick around. You're listening to Connecting Faith.
So fearfully and wonderfully made, how could they say there is no God? Reminded every breath that I take, it's by your hand I have been formed.
There's something that functions. There has to be a plan, a purpose behind it. And we're talking about it today. The undeniable understanding that life is designed, and Professor Douglas Ack has been proving that in the lab for a number of years, and he's working in the area of the evolution of proteins and protein systems. He's a molecular biologist, director of the Biologic Institute. It's a nonprofit research organization launched by the Discovery Institute in Seattle, and he's worked at Cambridge in a number of research and been written about in a number of journals published there. Also, in such books as Signature of the Cell and Darwin's Doubt from Stephen Meyer and A Life Solution from Simon Conway Morris. The book Undeniable tells us that there are some wobbly dominoes of accident, coincidence, and repetition that talk a little bit about the system that is in place now that is trying to explain how origins began. Talk about those dominoes a bit.
Sure. I did that just as there's a figure that shows these four dominoes that are poised to topple, and they have written on their sides first materialism, and then accident, and then coincidence, and then repetition. Just to give sort of a visual picture of the sequence of things that the false understanding of life is depending on. And it all starts with materialism, which is this philosophy that says there can't be anything other than the material world. So we're going to restrict our explanation of the origin of living things to material explanations. Everything else is ruled out of bounds. And that comes from scientism and materialism, two false philosophies. Well, if you've committed to that, then you're committing yourself to accidental causes of all things, but in particular, the invention of living things has to be explained in terms of accidental causes, because you have nothing else. You can't appeal to purpose, because you've committed yourself to material explanations. So whatever caused humans to arise, it was a series of accidents. And it turns out that if you're going to appeal to accidents and commit yourself to accidents, then these have to be very remarkable accidents. And really, the bulk of the book is showing, or a good chunk of the book, is showing the reader in very simple terms, you don't have to have a math background, just how remarkable these coincidences would have to be. But take my word for it now, in just a short time, they have to be remarkable coincidences, as in highly improbable. And the only way that you can overcome highly improbable coincidences, these are far beyond lottery winning. This is like winning the lottery 1,000 times in a row. When you get things like that, the only honest, the only material way to defeat odds like that is to have lots and lots of opportunities. So if the lottery is 1 in 10 million, if the odds of winning it are something like 1 in 10 million for a state lottery, if you are determined to win it, you can win it, but you'd have to be willing to play 10 million times or buy 10 million tickets, something like that. Well, what if the odds were 1 in a trillion and no state lottery has odds that are that bad or no one would play? But if they were that bad and you were determined to win, you would have to play about a trillion times. You'd have to buy a trillion tickets, which, of course, nobody can. But that same logic scales up. No matter what the improbability is of something happening, if you have the inverse of that number of chances for it to happen, then it can happen. The reason all four of these dominoes fall, I'm going to give the book away, they all fall, and they fall because some things are so improbable that there just aren't enough opportunities for them to happen. Once you get above something like 10 to the 40th things happening in living creatures, or 10 to the 100th power things happening anywhere in the universe, there just isn't enough time and space for these things to happen by accident. So they can't happen by accident. They have to happen intentionally if they're going to happen.
Well, you know, there's some that would say, well, you know, the reason that evolution is, you know, now we're into kind of the fiddling phase, is because that things are so fully developed now that we don't need the robust evolution like we did billions of years ago, when change was more needed to be more robust.
Yeah, this is a new take, and I think it's actually a response to our work and work of colleagues of ours. So a number of people, Michael Behe with Darwin's Black Box, started really making the argument for intelligent design, and now a number of scientists are making this argument and refining it, including me and the people who've worked with me in the lab. And we take this as a good sign that the other side keeps changing its defense of evolution. What we've shown actually in the lab is, if you look at modern enzymes, these are proteins that have been very brilliantly designed to do chemistry inside the cells. If you look at these, it appears that they are not capable of evolving new functions within an evolutionary time frame. And we're granting a very long evolutionary time frame of billions of years. It looks as though they cannot shift from one function to another. And we've studied one example of this very carefully and made this argument in a number of papers. Now, what is the response to that, Ben? It clearly seems to challenge the whole idea that you can get new things by simply having random mutations in natural selection. The response has been, of course, these enzymes, these modern enzymes, don't evolve. It's only the old kind that evolved and produced these modern ones. So you can't, in other words, the current defense of the theory says you can't find any more the sorts of things that did evolve because they've evolved to such a perfect form that the modern versions of these things no longer evolve. And people are saying that not just for molecules like proteins and enzymes. They're saying that for whole organisms, that of course you can't get a frog to evolve into something new. It's been perfected as a frog. So it's this interesting shift that would have shocked Charles Darwin had he heard it, because he certainly believed that everything is still evolving and that the same processes that have been at work shaping them are still shaping them and will reshape them forever. And that has all been thrown out the window now.
Mm. Well, there was another side too, and maybe it's sort of similar to it, but that there's almost that, well, it's kind of this no big deal approach to life development. You shine enough light on a puddle and eventually a plant's going to grow. I mean, that sort of gets back to our purposelessness, I guess, the view that life has no purpose or meaning, doesn't it?
You get various statements like this, and you know how when we talk about how many, and this has been in the news fairly recently, how many planets there are out there that we can see when we shine, when we look out into the night sky with very powerful telescopes or using the Hubble Space Telescope, how many planets are out there that could be Earth-like and could potentially support life. Now, the logic behind the hype that surrounds that kind of thing, or they'll talk about there could be water on this planet. The logic is that if you have a planet that's the right distance from a star out there and it has water, then very likely it's going to have life, or it's quite possible that it will have life, because all you need is the right kind of planet and water and life is bound to happen. The assumption there is that life must be easy to get started because it happened here and it evolved here. So all we need to do is find a planet that's like this, and the odds are pretty good that it will have evolved there, and it might be very different life there. So that sounds very intriguing. It turns out to be a massively wrong assumption that when you look at what would be needed for life to happen by accident, it's not just improbable, it's staggeringly improbable. I call it fantastically improbable in the book, meaning so improbable that it's impossible. And there's just a resistance to that idea in the biological community today.
Well, as you've talked and written throughout the book, you come down to, you know, as we understand worldviews, and, you know, if you're only operating on the material worldview, there's consequences there. And, you know, in any worldview discussion, we want to look at coherence. So is there any coherence in Darwin's theory?
I think if you strip it to its most minimal form, it is coherent. It's the claim that, well, the modern version of it, which couples mutation with selection and says that this is the way populations change, it's true, and it explains things like the fact that every winter we have a new version of the flu virus, of the influenza virus, that we need to go get vaccinated for. And why is that? Well, it's because once the human population becomes resistant to the 2016 version of the flu, it will require a change to the outer coat of this virus package in order for it to evade our immune systems. And sure enough, every year there will be one of these virus or several that pop up that have just enough change on their outside that our antibodies no longer recognize it. And that will be the 2017, 2018, and so on. That is well explained by neo-Darwinian theory, but it does not rise to the level of invention. It's not even a new virus. These are all influenza. They have the same parts that allow them to infect and make us miserable for a week. There's nothing new. It's simply the camouflage on the outside. The pattern of the camouflage slightly changes so that our influenza recognition system, which is brilliantly designed, no longer recognizes it. That's true. What isn't true is that that sort of evasion system, that sort of mutation to evade detection, can explain the origin of new things. It simply can't.
I'm curious to know if, you know, as you have, you know, faced some of the challenges and the restrictions, the scientific community is pretty strong about this belief. We mentioned whistleblowing. You had it going on. You know, normally I think of whistleblowing as sort of going against the establishment, but in this case, it's going against those like you who are considered outliers. Where do you see this debate going in the years to come?
Well, I've been involved in it for a long time now, and I use the term whistleblowing in the book to refer to people who are sort of the thought police that are sort of guarding the Darwinian orthodoxy within the academy. If someone steps out of line or even looks like they're stepping out of line, if someone says something that's hinting at the idea that maybe accidental causes are not sufficient to explain life, maybe we do need to take purpose seriously, people get upset about that, and they make phone calls behind people's backs, and they talk to editors, and they talk to people who are reviewing grants, and lo and behold, you can find yourself very quickly in a situation where you're struggling to keep your career going because of all the background whistleblowing happening. I tell briefly the story of my own. I lost my job at the Medical Research Council Center in Cambridge, headed up by Sir Alan Firth, who didn't get a Nobel Prize, okay, but he was knighted. So a very fine British scientist. And he found himself in a situation where the controversy was flaring up in a big way in the UK. He knew that I had been receiving funding from Discovery Institute, and he got scared, and he didn't want the controversy to land on his doorstep. And I got a mysterious email from, not from him, but from his assistant saying, "We need you to leave within 2 weeks. We've had a crunch on space. We need you to vacate within 2 weeks." So, and I couldn't find him for a further explanation, but I knew what had happened. I have thankfully been able to have some dialogue with him since then. And I opened the book actually talking about bumping into him almost literally when we were on summer vacation in the UK in Cambridge in 2013.
The bottom line is that a task that need knowledge to accomplish can be accomplished only by someone who has that knowledge, right? That's at the heart of it.
That is how that's the word that I put to this intuition, the universal design intuition. How is it that we just look at things and we know that they were made? And I think it comes down to that we are very good from an early age at recognizing things that were done, things that don't just happen accidentally, but someone did them. And I think we start thinking that way from, you know, our first and second year of life, because we want to do things. And so we recognize the sorts of things that are done because those are the sorts of things that we want to do. And once you get good at recognizing that, and that doesn't take long, you look at life and you realize, that's a done thing, and probably a done thing that's beyond anything I will ever do, but it's definitely a done thing.
Well, I hope you keep doing things, Douglas, because we are certainly benefiting from your writing and your insight. Thanks so much for coming on today.
That's been great. Thank you.
Dr. Douglas Axe is the director of the Biologic Institute's nonprofit research organization launched by Discovery Institute in Seattle, and he's written a wonderful book called Undeniable: How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. And it's readable, understandable, and I recommend it to you. We do have some copies to give away as well, and we'll do that drawing here in about 10 minutes. You can sign up for one today at 877-933-2484, 877-933-FAITH. Talking Undeniable today with Dr. Douglas Axe. And you're listening to Connecting Faith. We get a little bonus science conversation coming up with one of the leaders in the ID movement just ahead. You are, you are, you are, Undeniable, the name of the book. And you want to check out the website, undeniabledesign.com, for some great insight from Doug Axe, who writes in a way that we can understand, even though he is a molecular biologist, which I can hardly even say. But really interesting conversation, how biology confirms our intuition that life is designed. One of his fellow workers in the area of intelligent design is Michael Behe, who was kind of one of the leaders in that area, written several books, including Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. And some years ago, I had a chance to talk to Dr. Behe. He was coming to town, and we chatted a little bit about issues of ID. Is there a, for the general, the layman who's not a biochemist, is there a key argument or maybe just a question that we can raise if we get into some discussions like this?
Well, here's one. A problem for Darwin's theory is that it would have a tough time putting things together that need many parts to work. And an example I use from everyday life is a mousetrap. If you think of a mechanical mousetrap, it's got a spring, and it's got a holding bar, and it's got its wooden base, and a couple other metal parts. And it turns out it needs all of those things to work. If one of them were removed, then the trap would be broken. It wouldn't be able to catch any mice. And I have a term for that. I call it irreducibly complex. And those things turn out to be problems for a Darwinian-like process, because a Darwinian process has to change something, and it has to be an improvement so that it can spread in a population and then change again and be another improvement. But trying to gradually make an irreducibly complex system like a mousetrap is very, very difficult, because the trapping ability only appears when the system's put together. Well, it turns out, you know, mousetraps are interesting, but it turns out that science has discovered that at the very foundation of life in the cell, there are machines, quite literally machines made out of molecules, which are, in fact, irreducibly complex, much more so than a mousetrap. And so they fit very poorly with Darwin's theory. So just if somebody asks you, what's the problem here, say mousetrap. Say it's a big problem for Darwin's theory. Not only that, but we can immediately realize that a mousetrap was designed because we recognize design in the purposeful arrangement of parts. And when you see a number of parts arranged just so, and they have to be precisely positioned and so on in order to work, that's how we determine that something was designed. So irreducibly complex systems are both problems for Darwinism and strong pointers towards design.
I was reading an article, a critique of your book, and one of the issues that talked about was pseudogenes. Well, it's, you know, there's duplicate material there. So that's not necessarily complexity, that's just background.
Well, yeah, a lot of people confuse things, and they say that, well, okay, you say life was intelligently designed, then why did I, you know, cut myself when I was shaving this morning? And they seem to think that intelligent design means that nothing in life can go wrong, that there can't be accidents, there can't be mistakes. But there's no such requirement for intelligent design. Just like you would know that a car, even if it kind of crashed and, you know, one wheel was bent or something, you would still realize that that was intelligently designed. In the same way, in the DNA of a cell, if the DNA codes for proteins and they all work together to perform very sophisticated functions, to make molecular machines, to encode information, and so on. But over on the left, there was a kind of a broken piece of something. You would not conclude that, therefore, all of that working machinery arose by chance. Let me give you just one more. Analogy. Suppose somebody had a block, piece of block, and they whittled, you know, whittled a figure from the block, like, you know, a wooden copy of Mount Rushmore or something. And when they were done, they had this thing, and there were a bunch of wood chips on the floor. Well, wouldn't it be kind of silly for somebody to come along and point at the wood chips and say, hey, you know, that means, look at all those chips. They have no function. That means that that figure of, say, the president's or whatever must have come about by accident. So pseudogenes are genes which kind of look like functioning genes, but they have features in them that make some people think that they can't work, at least in the usual way. And so they say that they are accidents. And my response is, well, yeah, maybe they are. You know, nobody said that genetic accidents can't happen, even in a design system. But the fact that they might be mistakes, and I should say that they might not be mistakes too, because it turns out that people are finding out that pseudogenes can actually do other things in the cell, things other than what the normal genes do. But even if they were mistakes, that does not prove that the functioning parts of the cell, or it has no bearing on the fact that the functioning parts of the cell are best explained by design.
It does seem that the continuing weight of evidence, you've got 30 years researching in biochemistry, that, I mean, the more that we find out, is there sort of a tipping point, maybe in terms of the weight of evidence that says, you know, we just can't simply put our head in the sand and ignore this anymore?
Yeah, I think there will be, but it's tricky predicting when that will be. I like to liken it to the fall of communism, not because the Darwinists are bad guys like communists or anything like that, but it's just that everybody knew for a long time that communism wasn't working, even economically as it was promised, and it was a dying system, but there were vested interests that wanted to keep it running, and it was a series of accidents that kind of historical accidents where it kind of toppled over in the late 1980s. It might be that way with Darwinism too. It's, you know, I think it's plain that it's already you know, a poor theory, and actually a lot of scientists think that Darwinism is a poor theory, but they're shy about the idea of intelligent design. But predicting when that tipping point will come is something that's beyond me.
Michael Behe, who is one of the leading proponents and developers of intelligent design, and has since gone on to write several important books about it: Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution, one of them, and The Edge of Evolution, The Search for the Limits of Darwinism. He's part of the Discovery Institute as well. We also talked to Doug Axe earlier, Professor Douglas Axe, about his new book, Undeniable, which is pretty fascinating. UndeniableDesign.com is the website. And I don't know, did you learn a little bit today?
I did. It's so good to be equipped to engage conversation with somebody instead of just being defensive. You can actually talk these things out.
There's a lot of wobbly dominoes there. Speaking of wobbly things, we're going to talk bioethics tomorrow. There's summer school's and apparently day two
going
on tomorrow.
Keep it going.
Because C. Ben Mitchell will join us, who's a professor of moral philosophy and ethics. But just recently, the 24th annual conference of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, and was talking about reproductive technology, all these things. I mean, you can hardly believe what's going on today. So we'll get an update on where some of those moral front lines are, and I hope that you'll join us tomorrow for Connecting Faith. You missed part of today's show, you want to pass it on to a friend. We post all the interviews on the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. They're all shareable, so listen again, pass it on. I'd love to have you listening anytime at myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.